I've now met so many regular people with 8 and 9 figure Roth IRAs on which you won't owe any taxes at all. And a lot of them have done that with vanilla investing. I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to.
I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back. I think that we're going to do basically like first half of this is like money tips, meaning like, you know, sort of like personal finance stuff that nobody really teaches you, you know, because we get most of our personal finance information either in from two really bad sources, either your parents who probably only knew so much. And like when you're a little kid, you think your dad knows everything. But then when you grow up, you're like, oh, he's just a guy. And like, you know, he did the best he could with what he had. And the other thing is like, you know, TV or books or salespeople who's like their incentive is very different than yours, right? Like one of my favorite YouTube videos is like about, it has a picture of Jim Cramer and it says, will this very loud man make me money? And it's like, no, he will not. The blinking lights on this guy's screen and that this money guy on TV is not the guy to listen to. So we'll do that. And then you had a bunch of business ideas also, like that you've been brainstorming, your cheat sheet of startup ideas. So we'll go to that after. But
Sean, do you guys know each other well, by the way? I don't even know.
We've never hung out in person.
We've never hung out. We've exchanged. We've tried to hang out. Haven't hung out. The last episode was the closest we've gotten.
I like you though, every time we talk.
Yeah.
So let me introduce you. Sean, this is my friend Ankur. Ankur, this is my friend Sean. I've known Ankur since 2012 or 2013, and we've been buddies since. And I've known Sean since 2013, 2014.
I think I'm one of the only people at this point that's met Sam through the internet who's had beers with him. That's how far back we go.
It was a long way. It was a long time ago.
So give his background, his bio.
So when I met Ankur, he was doing a Facebook app that went viral, and he made his first couple million dollars at the age of like 26 or 27.
No, bro, 20.
What was the app?
All the silly stuff, personality quizzes, friend quizzes, how like answer 7 questions and you find out how good a kisser you are, crazy stuff like that.
Then he started a company called Teachable. He was early on the course game. He didn't quite bootstrap that company, but he owned the majority of it and sold it for something like $150 million, which I'm sure you're going to correct me if I was too low. And then now you have a new company called Carry. Was I too low?
It's 250, but close enough. It's all a rounding error at that point.
But you made like $100 million when you were, what, 32 years old?
Yep.
I mean, that's insane, right?
Did it feel more insane to make $1 million on a silly Facebook app, like how good of a kisser are you? Or was it more insane to make $100 million on this company that you know, this education company?
Zero to something is always more life-changing, undoubtedly, right? Like that was also the time where I just moved to America. I was an international student. I was so new to everything, but like making money in college allowed me to like not go to class and like realize that if I can do things on the internet, like why ever get a regular job?
How much money did you have in your bank account before you sold Teachable?
Like 1.5, 2. Like basically I was flat. I didn't really spend money or grow money during that entire sort of time. Paid myself eventually a salary of 150 grand, which in New York was like roughly my life break even.
So then when you got your exit, you just moved the decimal points to place like 2 points, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, we made like a little bit over 40 in cash. The rest is equity, but the equity is pretty nice. It's just this random thing that, you know, keeps paying you out.
I love that you're open with money. I'm almost out of question. What else can we ask this guy? He's divulging everything. This is amazing. Well, you sent us this list of topics and you said, when I sold my company, I ran an A-B test with the money I made. I gave half to Goldman Sachs to invest and I invested the other half yourself, I assume. Can you just talk about this? Why'd you do this and what was the result?
So like a lot of founders that first sell a business, most of us know nothing about money. I don't know, Sam, if you knew much or whatever. And you get hit up by every single one of the private wealth people. They're always in your emails and, you know, you read the big brand, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. So I talked to them. I couldn't fully tell how legit they were. And I had enough money where I'm like, you know what, let me take a sizable chunk. Let me give them that amount of money and see what they do. The other half, let me try and learn and figure stuff out myself. And went through sort of the standard startup, post-exit startup founder thing where you invest probably in too much. You don't say no enough. You go through a period where you think you're an investing genius. But it was cool to sort of see that develop over 5 years and now to have actual results.
And what were they?
What are the results?
The results are, in retrospect, there's nothing that special about private banking. There's a lot of clout that comes with it, but you look at the sort of portfolios they do, they're very vanilla and they charge you anywhere between 50 basis points to, you know, 120 basis points. The best part of my portfolio that they did was simply indexing the S&P. The S&P has returned about 13% in that time. They did a lot of other stupid shit that averaged it down to 6%.
What sort of stupid shit did they get you into? Was it like exotic, you know, was it random exotic things? Was it real estate? What are they putting you into? And were you saying yes or no on a case-by-case basis, or they were making decisions?
So they're clear. They brought your average down to 6%?
They did, yeah.
Dude, that's like the meme where there's like a guy like putting a stick in his own front spoke as he's riding his bicycle.
Yeah. But again, the insane part is I genuinely think now that I know more about this, like you can't fully judge the performance based on like five great years. Like theoretically, that portfolio should protect your ass in down years of the market, right? We've also had an atypically good time. But the things that were rough with them is one, for a lot of products, they charged over 100 basis points to basically do what Vanguard funds could have done. They also put a lot of fixed income, which is bonds and stuff, that it's a 31, 32-year-old with like infinite risk tolerance. It doesn't really make sense, right? So eventually I got them out of doing a lot of those things. But the whole process of kind of working with them, you realize all these people, their product has such insanely good margins that they can afford to do whatever. And they really sort of sell a lifestyle that now that I know more, it doesn't make sense for me. But for a lot of people who are new to the idea of having money, it's kind of a, you know, it's a status thing as well, right?
Like, but what are the perks of the status? I mean, you're a single guy. Surely you're not walking around with a t-shirt that says I work with Goldman. Like
what did you do?
It didn't make sense for me. Like for me, I never valued it that much, but yes, they have a, you know, a concierge team that can, you know, get you tickets to the US Open and like take you out for nice dinners whenever you want. I was the wrong target demographic because when they wanted to get dinner, I'm like, oh, fuck, it's another person to hang out with. But there's a lot of people who really enjoyed that side of it.
They're like, these tech guys are the best. They're introverts. They don't even take us on any of the free shit. We just get to charge them the fees.
That's a really expensive US Open seat.
Correct. I mean, you do the math, right? And because you get charged a percentage of your assets, you never feel the pain, but you're paying them six figures a year. If you had to cut them a check for $10,000 a month, you're like auditing that all the time. But that is what is so genius about this business model, where you basically just keep running through this. And over the course of your lifetime, you end up with many, many millions of dollars in fees. And it's not just the fees, those dollars would otherwise be invested. So whenever you run the math, you realize your ending portfolio is probably $10 million smaller 20 or 30 years from now.
Cutting your sales cycle in half sounds pretty impossible, but that's exactly what Sandler Training did with HubSpot. They use Breeze, HubSpot's AI tools, to tailor every customer interaction without losing their personal touch. And the results were incredible. Click-through rates jumped 25%. Qualified leads quadrupled, and people spent three times longer on their landing pages. Go to HubSpot.com to see how Breeze can help your business grow. But what's the argument against this? Because they've been around for 100 years. They're huge. A lot of smart, rich people use it. Surely they're, I mean, what's the value?
I think the sweet spot, and in fact, I think our friend Ramit talks about this a lot, is I think financial advice is incredibly valuable. I think they serve a really good purpose. But at a certain point, the math on going flat fee is just substantially better for you, right? Like if you have $5 million, $50 million, $500 million, they don't do dramatically more things, yet at every step you pay an order of magnitude more in fees. I think there's a lot of fantastic financial advisors. You pay them $5,000 a year, $10,000 a year, $20,000 a year. I don't care. You can easily get an ROI there, but it's the whatever, 1% of your wealth. That's the part that gets really silly the better and better you do.
I want to ask you about indexing. So indexing is obviously super popular now. And you had some note on like simple other ways you can index that are, you know, maybe things that people should consider.
Yeah. So in general, like my overall thesis is most people, you're not going to get crazy differentiated performance from investing, but that's actually okay. It's kind of wild that an average person, like again, think about my example. I had all these financial advisors. I had so much differentiated access. We know so many entrepreneurs, founders, whatever. the best part of my portfolio was indexing the S&P 500. And historically, that happened a lot. So most people should not try and find alpha on the investment side. However, if you can be smart about saving money on taxes, that is where your alpha comes from. So one example, I think Sam and I talked about this on Twitter. I've started to do something called direct indexing, where instead of buying a Vanguard fund, it buys each and every one of the 500 companies individually. And the advantage with that is you have more positions, so more volatility. At any given point, more companies are down. So you harvest those losing positions. So net-net, you track the same as an index, but you'll get 30, 40% of your investment as a usable tax loss.
Sam, do you do this, by the way?
No, because I think I'm not entirely well-versed on it, but I don't do it because what I'm doing is working, just indexing, and I sleep better at night. And number two, from my understanding, Ankur, those gains eventually go away. So it
unless you're investing on an ongoing basis. So if you do a lump sum investment, after 3 years, you'll harvest most of your losses. But if you're investing X amount per year, that kind of infinitely goes long.
But no, Sean, yeah. I don't do it. Do you?
Yeah, I do. So I invested in this company called Freck, and they do this. So, Ankur, have you seen Freck?
I'm actually a little bit nervous because I use them as well, but I don't want to be their biggest customer. I have a couple $1 million on Freck, and I don't want to put like, nervous about putting like 5 or 10 or whatever on them. I'm an investor too. But yes, I use them.
The guy's really smart behind it. He sort of sat me down and explained it because I was like, look, don't assume I don't know anything because I read this and it sounds good, but it's kind of hand wavy to me. Like, how does this actually work? So he explained it and I said, okay, cool. So I put $250K in as a test. So I'm basically doing the exact same thing I otherwise would have been doing.
Exactly.
Which is indexing the S&P. So I got the same performance as the S&P, but I on my $250K, I added an extra $16,000 in tax loss harvesting, just holding the same exact asset as I would before. And so, I was like, wait, should I give this startup like millions of dollars or how do I want to do this? And like, you know, then he's like, well, we don't, you know, all fintech is basically built on top of other like
providers,
you know, other pools of money. So, you know, it's not a startup that holds your money. It's like, you know, the custodian's usually somebody else. Same thing with Robinhood and others. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I think it's kind of amazing.
Like an even simpler example, if direct indexing is too hard, is most people right now keep their cash in like a high yield savings account or something. But if you are a high taxpayer, there's likely better places for it. There's either muni funds where you pay no federal taxes. There's treasuries where you don't pay state and local taxes. There's muni funds specific to New York and California where you won't pay federal and state taxes. Like we built a very simple product that will just take your cash, calculate your tax rate, and find the best money market fund for you. That itself will take your tax equivalent yield from like 3-4% to like 6-7%.
When I hear you say all this, for most people, when they talk about this, I see a lot of people talk about this. And I think to myself, you guys should just focus on earning more money. You should increase your revenue first. Increase the revenue and then worry about...
Totally. Like there's some percentage of people where they're like, oh, my business makes $50,000 a year. How do I save money on taxes? It's like, bro, you don't have a tax problem, right? You need to make more money.
Like I was at a bike shop the other day and I was like looking at a bike and there was a bike that was $2,500 and then there was a bike that was like $5,000 and I was like, what's the difference? And they were like 2 pounds, so it's a lot. And then like this water bottle was made out of carbon and this, and I was like, well, I'm kind of chubby, so why don't I just lose weight? You know, like why don't I just like I could like lose 5 pounds just by not eating for like, you know, a week and I'll save myself that money and I'll be fitter. How about that? And that's kind of the same thing.
Absolutely. I think for people like it matters at our level when the compounding and stuff makes a big difference. But at like 30, 40, 50K in revenue, making more money is far more effective.
Well, I was going to say two things. One, this like direct indexing. I like these because these are set it and forget it. I made a decision. It took me 2 seconds to just roll. I literally push a button and it does an ACAT rollover of my... S&P ETF holding, my Vanguard ETF holding from one brokerage to theirs. I never had to do anything. So it's like, it was a 2 second change that has since yielded like, you know, 18K, 16K of extra tax losses that I harvest. Yeah, exactly. Like, so I don't have to do anything. I would never do that if it was like something I have to keep thinking about or keep doing something on a regular basis. Same thing what you're talking about with the buying muni bonds versus holding cash in a money market fund, right? If you're just going to put cash in a place and be like, okay, it's earning like 3-4%. Well, if you could just do the same thing with a muni bond and just not pay the state taxes, like it's the same one decision, didn't take you any extra time.
For the average person, though, I would say for the person doing nothing, fuck it, do a Vanguard fund. That the most important thing is to do something. But for the people that already have an index fund, this is the sort of alpha.
What else is on the list of like, all right, you're wired tens of millions of dollars, you're worth nine figures. I expected this to happen in terms of financial investments. Someone was going to present like this amazing deal to me. Someone was going to offer this amazing service. And it just was not what I thought. And everyone could have access to this.
For the first time, I felt like it didn't matter if I failed, even though arguably I needed the dollars more. Now it would feel so stupid to fail. I've been on panels telling other people how you should run your company. And, you know, they, you have like this time, everyone who joined the company did it because they're like, oh, you know, this guy will succeed again. So I feel like my pressure on myself, and it's fully my own construct at the end of the day.
Can we switch away from emotions and you tell me about a mega backdoor Roth? I don't really care how you feel. I just really want to know about this Roth tax optimization. What
this has been kind of wild.
I want to know how Peter Thiel made $5 billion and didn't pay any tax on it. What was that?
Talk dirty to me, baby.
Tell me how you feel later. Talk dirty,
Whisper softly and tell me about my backdoor Roth.
A lot of people read about Peter Thiel. What he did, which is like tax magic, is most people have access to a Roth IRA. He put his PayPal founder shares in a Roth IRA, sold those for about $27 million, then used this as a supercharged investment account to where it is today, where he has $5 billion in his Roth. He retires next year, so he gets all of that with no taxes.
But you got to dumb this down, man. What's a Roth IRA? Like, you got to like talk down to me a little bit.
So Roth IRA is an account that the government basically has gifted to taxpayers. There's a guy named William Roth who I think, you know, 15, 20 years ago or whatever, created this account ideally for the middle class. It was never meant to be for the richest people, where you put in after-tax money, but then all further growth in that account is tax-free, including no matter how high tax rates go in the future, right? So if you look back in the 1970s, do you know what the top tax rate was in America?
It was like 20%.
It was like 80%. It was insane. Like the top marginal bracket was like 80 or, it was super high. But the advantage of a Roth IRA is once you have dollars in, no matter how high taxes get, you pay nothing on what is in that account.
And what was the incentivization there for these people?
So it was a very short-term incentive at the time, because the advantage is the government gets the tax revenue today because you're putting in after-tax dollars today. What you're giving away in the future is future revenue, but you're actually collecting more money up front.
I'm saying, why would the government agree to this?
They want to incentivize retirement savings in general, and compared to traditional IRA, this brings tax revenue forward. But it was always designed in a way that there was a maximum income. Once you make more than a certain amount, you are not supposed to have access. Today, those numbers are, I think, $150,000 or something. You don't really have access if you go the normal route. But that's where you have things called a backdoor Roth IRA.
So before you explain that, so basically it was if you make under a certain amount, you can put away some $7,000 or whatever a year. And you've already paid tax on it. You put it there. Now it's going to compound tax free. When you take it out, after all those investments have compounded, you don't pay any taxes on that money because you sort of paid it up front.
Does it have to be an age limit, like 65?
You have to, you get your dollars at 59 and a half, but you can take out the dollars you contribute at any point for any reason. It's only the growth that is kind of locked up.
So what Peter Thiel did, which was great, was he put his PayPal shares in there when they were valued at nothing. So it was like,
exactly.
He
bought his founder's shares at like $0.0001 or whatever.
And he probably knew, hey, this is a good chance that this thing can become valuable. It's crazy, by the way. He only made $27 million on PayPal.
Yeah, $27 million. Or at least from this Roth IRA. He put in $1,700 worth of founder shares and he made $27 or $28 million.
Okay. So then he used that money to invest in Facebook within his Roth IRA. So then the Facebook gain is why it became billions of dollars.
Exactly. But you then read about Mitt Romney doing the same thing. But because I'm in this line of work, I've now met so many regular people with eight and nine figure Roth IRAs, which is insane because you have, you know, $10 to $100 million on which you won't owe any taxes at all. And a lot of them have done that with somewhat vanilla investing. Like,
so tell me a story of someone who's done this with so 8 or 9 figures. So you're saying 10 million or 100 million.
Yes, exactly. So Roth IRA limits are normally $7,000 a year. The challenge with that is it's tough to get a lot of money in. The whole game becomes, how do I get a lot of money in? Once you get 20 million, going from 20 to much more is actually easier. It's how do you get the first amount of dollars in? So in addition to the backdoor Roth IRA, there's something called the mega backdoor Roth IRA, which the names on these. Yeah, the naming on this is not ideal. But
what about the triple mega?
The triple mega, right? It's like the least creative names of all time. But the mega backdoor Roth IRA lets you use a 401k to get in $70,000 a year into this account. So you can combine the two, get in $77,000 a year. Actually, sanity tested this. I built a very simple model that makes the assumption that you start contributing to Roth IRA by 21, the mega backdoor by like 30. Even if you just index the S&P and you looked at the 100-year average of the S&P, you end up with $30 million in your Roth IRA at retirement. So it's, if you do this consistently enough, the tax benefit here is massive.
Okay, so who came up with this mega?
mega backdoor. Yeah. So the way people find loopholes is the IRS never intends for it to be this way. They write the law a certain way. Some smart-ass accountant is like, well, actually, if you do this, this, and this, we're still fully in compliance. The IRS challenges this, loses in court, and that's how we have loopholes. Like every single loophole comes the same way. The mega backdoor Roth, for instance, there's been legislation to outlaw it for the last few years. It comes up every time. But the existence of the fact that someone wants to make it illegal by default deems this is a valid loophole for now. So it's the sort of thing that, like, this gets negotiated down every single time. Every single tax bill has it. Typically, the Republicans fight against it, and it just gets deferred and deferred and deferred.
All right. Okay. And what are examples of people who have done this to $10 or $100 million?
So,
what do you want, their name and address? What do you want them to say?
No, you could do a little Chatham House rules. You could kind of like anonymize them a little bit.
So I will tell you that these are people that you and I have never heard of. There's just a lot of like anonymous, wealthy, financially savvy people where it's a coalition of families and they have a family office that specializes in this sort of tax alpha as a service. But it's just a case of doing all the fundamentals together and then having very, very good investments. But I think if you can structure your 401k in a way that you can put in $70,000 a year into your Roth IRA, which I do now, honestly, just the sport of it is fun enough. And you do this over a long enough period of time, you have these results. It's the sort of thing that we don't know how long this loophole will exist. But for now, it's like, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars with $0 in taxes. It's very good insurance from where tax rates may go in the future.
Should we switch to business ideas, Sam?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cool. So, Ankur, you sent us a list of ideas that you think any founder could go build, or you think that some founder should go build in this space. And you've started multiple successful companies now. So maybe you have interesting tastes, and maybe you're looking where other people are not. Because when I saw this list of ideas, these were not the like same five AI, you know, assistant ideas that you hear from most people. So hit us with your favorite one, and let's go in order.
Sweet. So I'll go in somewhat random order because I have a few different ones. But one of the things I think about a lot is right now there's such a focus on proactive health and wellness. I don't know, New York City, for instance, people are spending all their time not at bars and clubs, but at, you know, saunas and cold plunges or whatever. And you have all these high-end executive services for like concierge health, basically, you know, superpower function health.
You guys have to explain this. So basically what they do is you do a blood test and they tell you all about your body and everything. But this has existed for decades. I've been using it. I started using these years and years and years ago. This company, Function Health, has skyrocketed. And I think in the course of like 2 or 3 years, it got to $100 million in revenue. I believe they've just raised another round of funding in the billions. I have no idea why this category is booming like it is, because it doesn't, I don't know how this makes it any different from the decades of other companies doing this before.
And it's commoditized. Everyone uses the same blood testing companies. It's but I'm telling you, we're just moving to a world of proactive wellness. Like, I think everyone has realized, like, the medical system in the US is you kind of sit back and wait for really bad things to happen. And people of our generation have realized that you want to be proactive about this and not just kind of chill.
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of factors, right? Like, there's the Brian Johnsons of the world. So now you have these really big attention-getting influencers who are bringing attention to, you know, your health and wellness and making you realize, like, how much of a knowledge gap there is, how much more you could be doing. You might have thought you were already doing enough, and then somebody shows you that there's a new level to enough, right? So you have the influencer side. Underneath, you have all the infrastructure. So you have lab testing in all these different places. So you can go get your blood drawn. You know, when I went on Superpower, it's like, cool. Go, you know, do you want a nurse to come to your house? Or do you want to go 0.8 miles away and there's three locations near you? And I was like, wow, this is like amazingly convenient. Then the next piece is that I think the HIPAA laws changed, or the medical records stuff changed. So I just gave them my ID and they pulled all my health records. I never even had that myself. Like, they have my health records now in a beautiful website. They pulled all my medical history, which, like, I could, if I wanted to go look at my own medical history, I couldn't have even done that before. So, like, that was a change that happened. So you have all these different things sort of stacking on top of each other that, like Ankur said, like a cultural movement towards status being associated with being healthy rather than being a degenerate, right? Like, before, in my circles, the more you partied, the cooler you were, right? The more sort of bad for you your lifestyle was, the cooler you were. Now, the more good for you the lifestyle you have, the better, the cooler you are. And I don't know if it's just I changed or culture changed.
Tell me, how were your results?
Oh, you didn't see my tweet about this?
Yeah.
What did you say?
I said, oh, I just found out that my chronological age, 37, is different than my biological age, 40. But long term, I'm not concerned because I'm just going to go ahead and kill myself now. Because you never see someone share their results where their age is worse than their actual age. It's always like, oh, look, I have the body of a 23-year-old, you know, Russian gymnast. Cool. Thanks for I'm so happy I use this app.
Why were you so?
I'm the only person I've ever seen with a higher biological.
I've never seen anyone. No,
I think I broke a record.
Yeah. What was so old about you?
So it's pretty cool because actually the next thing that happens is they go, there's a concierge doctor who basically is going to, in a week, give you kind of an action plan. So it says, oh, okay, look, we did these 30 tests in a single blood draw. They do these like 30 tests, right? And they say, look, right now, let's say, I don't know, let's just pretend it's like your LDL is high or low, whatever the something is wrong. And then they'll basically start to talk to you. So there's a little concierge, a little chat here where somebody's going to then work with me to develop maybe an action plan, things I could be doing. Eating slightly differently, whatever, walking more steps, whatever you people do. Go to cold plunge for 6 minutes, yeah. All those things. And you come up with an action plan. So, you know, whether this is like life-changing or not, they're probably just going to be like, yo, like delete DoorDash off your phone. Like, you know, that'll probably do the trick. Like there's a few different ways that you can help somebody. But again, like, this is not how normal medicine works. Normal medicine is a car, you know, mechanic. You go there when you're broken, they try to fix it. And most of the time they're like, yeah, it'll never really run the same, right? Like we're in maintenance mode from here on out. Whereas at least this operates under the assumption of being proactive rather than reactive. And that there's actually something you could do. There's actual lifestyle steps you could take and not simply like medicines you can get on to improve your health.
Yeah.
All right, my friends, I have a new podcast for you guys to check out. It's called Content is Profit, and it's hosted by Luis and Fonzie Cameo. After years of building content teams and frameworks for companies like Red Bull and Orange Theory Fitness, Luis and Fonzie are on a mission to bridge the gap between content and revenue. In each episode, you're going to hear from top entrepreneurs and creators, and you're going to hear them share their secrets and strategies to turn their content into profit. So you can check out Content is Profit wherever you get your podcast.
I also think in addition to all of that, I do genuinely believe a lot of people are sicker than before, particularly like in the US. And some of my other ideas have to do with that. But I do think you look around, whether it's like fertility, gut health, allergies, like shit's kind of falling apart in a lot of places. And people are reacting to that.
But by the way, the upsell in this thing is crazy because the initial deal is super good, right? So it's like $500 and you're going to have like a 10 times better version of your annual physical. It's like, okay, that's actually like a good trade that you don't need to be super wealthy to do. Like you can pay $500 and get a better version of your physical. But when you're in there, it's like, you want to know how that gut's doing? Want a microbiome test? I'm like, yeah, I'd love to. Yeah.
Click next, the upsell page on Function Health. I did Function Health. I clicked next. I'm not joking, 15 times.
I didn't even click next. I clicked yes. I was like, yep, give me an allergy test. Give me a toxins test in my blood. Give me the gut test. I basically did every single test except for the like blood, like cancer test one. And I just said yes to all of them. So they upsold me like a couple $1,000 worth of tests. But honestly, like, great. I wish my doctor had been offering me these. Like, why doesn't my doctor like offer me these? Either of these tests
they
are
do
bullshit.
It, they do it the other way around. They're like, oh, you want to get your testosterone checked? You look fine.
What's the problem? yeah. What's your wife say to you? I'm like, what? Why is this so personal?
So what's your idea here?
So a lot of these services are doing really well. I think you cut out the motivation a lot of times for people is the aesthetic side of it too. People want to look good. I think if you had a Function Health, but for your physical appearance, it would completely crush. So it's like you come in, it's like, wow, Sean, your hairline has receded 2 inches, and you tie in a DEXA scan to it. But basically, like a concierge service to elevate your experience. Like two of my college roommates are plastic surgeons, right? And I've heard a little bit about that side of the business, but marrying these two ideas, basically concierge lookups with improving your aesthetics, I think is a fantastic business.
This is actually a great idea.
We had Justin Mayers on the podcast and his skin was glowing. Like it was
He's
glowing.
Telling us about like his inner health, and we were just like, he's handsome.
I was like, dude, your hair is full, your skin has a glow, your teeth look nice. Can you just tell me about that? And so, yeah, I'm on board.
We went out to breakfast, Sam, and literally everything he ordered, I just said, whatever this man eats, I need to eat. So he ordered this drink. I said, the waiter looked at me. I said, did you not understand the instructions? Whatever this man eats, I eat. And so I had an identical meal to him.
But I think you have to. Like, Stamina are investors in a testosterone company, and if the founder was not jacked, I would not have invested in the company. Like, I think
that's true. Sean's in on that too, by the way. It seems like we've all invested in the same stuff.
Yeah, so you have to look the part in order to do it. So I think, I think businesses focused around the aesthetic part of it would crush. I mean, you already have concierge medicine in Turkey, stuff like that. Secondly, I think anything that helps us break out of the U.S. food system will do quite well. And again, probably more so in cities like New York, but it's kind of funny. Like every Friday evening, I go and meet my like raw milk dealer, which is super sketchy. It's this like Amish farm that like drives in. It's illegal. So you know, they literally park on the side of the street. You make this little transaction. But I have a lot of people that just want to break out of the US food system. And I think businesses that enable people to do that will go quite a long way.
And so how did you find this Amish farm? Like what was your process to find this this alternative?
So it was word of mouth. A lot of my friends were all talking about it. And then someone's like, oh, I get my beef from this place. And it actually started out with like, you know, you buy beef and then you get upsold in all the other products. And now before you know it, my like soap is made out of goat milk and shit that's probably not even relevant or helping. But, you know, they were pretty nice business. But yeah, they go straight from farm to like, they drive out to New York City. They have this little truck. They park the truck on the side of a street corner. You have a 30-minute window to meet them. And as much as I joke about it, it's actually pretty cool. It does improve the quality of my life. I do think the products taste well. Raw dairy is more of a novelty. That's something that like, sure, I'll add $4 for the raw milk. But I think breaking out of the US food system, at least, you know, we'll see what RFK does, but in the short term, I think there are a lot of people that will pay quite a bit of money for.
Do you get all your meat from this Amish fellow?
I do. It's so good. Like, dude, I don't like chicken in America. Like, as someone that's traveled a lot, most chicken here at a grocery store tastes like nothing to me. Like, you can't really taste anything. But here it actually, you know, again, but it's such a big difference if you have the same stuff outside the U.S.
We all need one of these Amish guys.
Isn't this what a farmer's market is supposed to be, by the way?
It is what a farmer's market is supposed to be. This feels more authentic, right? This feels more real.
Well, Phil, the way you described it, it's more like a drug deal. And that kind of appeals to me in a way. Like farmer's market, it's a little bit like a cute date on a Sunday morning. But like, I kind of like an element of danger with my groceries.
This is contraband. This is contraband.
Exactly.
So not only that, when you buy something and all the signs on it will very clearly say, not for human consumption, but it's like, wink, wink, for human consumption.
Oh, I'm in. Can we ground it up and inject it in my veins? That's usually what I do when it says not for human consumption.
For cats and dogs only.
Does it make you feel better, by the way, this stuff?
It does. I mean, of course, you have to like control for placebo effect and stuff, but generally, yes, I do feel better when I'm eating this. And
Or don't control for placebo. Placebo is the best shit.
Placebo is a mess, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I read about these, I'm like, wait, so you have to like study, like when we talk about placebo, we act like it's an issue. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're telling me I could take a fake thing and it gives me the real result? Give me all of the fake things. All I ever want is the fake thing.
No, it's. I mean, the only reason I even went down this rabbit hole is I remember I've had multiple times in my life where I'd like live a very healthy New York life, like cook my own food or whatever, and then I'd go to like Argentina for a month, live like a degenerate, and I'm like, I feel better, like my physical body feels better, and I don't think it was the addition of the alcohol. I think it was just the food system.
It could have been that. It could have been some of the other stuff you were doing down there too.
Yeah. Could have been never. All right. Next idea is a travel agent, but for credit card points. Like, again, we already talked about this, right? I'm on the cutting edge of a lot of personal finance shit. I still find it a pain in the ass sometimes to actually find the right flights. Like right now I have 250,000 Amex points, 100,000 Chase points. I'd pay a good amount of money for someone to go find me 2 first class tickets to someplace warm in the summer.
How do you want this to work?
I want this to be a concierge service. I want to tell people exactly what I have, like what are the points or whatever I have and where I'd like to go, including like for a lot of times, I don't even care where I want to go. It can be, you know, a warm destination in a certain part of the world.
So
and they just do it for me.
Jack Smith is a friend of all of ours, I believe. Yep. Jack Smith, very, when he suggests something, you take it seriously, even though he's one of the strangest people ever. But there's like, you know that he's like thoughtful enough that there's some unique reason why he uses this. He only books his flight via flightfox.com. And I've used it a couple times, but basically you sign up and at the time, I think it was free. Now it looks like it's $20 per ticket. You tell them like roughly when you want to do something, and there's a human on the other end who goes and books it for you, and they spend like 2 hours per flight finding a flight for you.
Their business doesn't make sense. Like, what's their margin on this?
Yeah. I have no idea, but I have booked 3 or 4 flights on this, and it is amazing. It works every time.
Can you enter like your credit card points and stuff, or is this just dollars?
Yeah, so they'll either just pay for it and book it for me, or they'll give me the exact flights to book, and then I go to Delta.com and book it. And let me tell you another crazy thing. Have you ever bought or sold another person's miles?
No, but that's the kind of stuff that, like, I think businesses had made that easier. There's so much value to be unlocked there.
Have you ever heard of this, Sean?
I've heard of it. I've never done it before. Have you done it?
I've done it. So I booked a flight where I had a friend who spent roughly $10 or $15 million a year on advertising with his Amex card or some credit card. And he is like, I have all of these points. If you wire me the money, I will book the plane ticket for you and I will take a small fee and you get the discount. And I did. And I think the flights, I think I saved 40% or 30%, something like pretty significant, because I was buying like six first class flights. It was very expensive, and it was like thousands of dollars that I saved.
So who's this friend? Basically, what they're doing, but as a true sort of professionalized service, is how I would like it to work. And I think you can now automate a lot of the back end with
but there's
smart
an issue.
Tech and stuff.
This is highly not illegal, but it's against the terms and service of all these airlines. And so if you get caught doing it, I think they take your ticket.
I feel like a disproportionate number of my ideas are turning out to be illegal, but
yeah. Yes. So what were you saying about the financial services company that you currently run?
All right, let's
illegal raw milk.
I don't want my chief compliance officer to message me after. I should add, nothing shared here should be considered as legal advice, investment advice, or tax advice. Everything is for informational and educational purposes only.
Or health advice.
That's fine. That's not that regulated in this country.
No, but you're right on the points thing. So like I use Seats.Aero, I think, which is basically you plug in what points you have, and it's like a search engine, but it's like very slow. It's very hard, and I have to do it myself. You're absolutely right. Like I want either a human or I need like AI to be able to do this, where it just knows. I just say what I'm trying to do, and sometimes it's as fuzzy as what you described. Like I just want to go somewhere warm in the summer. Like it's okay if it's Puerto Vallarta, and it's okay if it's Hawaii, right? Like I'm not as dead set on, and sometimes I am dead set on a date and a place. Yep. Sometimes I'm not, right? But either way, be able to make use of these points, because I think I have 7 million Amex points.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much arbitrage.
Wait, you have 7 million?
Yeah, at least 7 million.
Well, how does that convert? Is that like $70,000?
Once you get good at it, the value is so much more than the dollar amount. But finding the person, but the average person is not going to get good at it. So finding the intermediary that's good at it, extracts some value off the top.
Even though you're incredibly wealthy, do you still, so you still use airline points like crazy?
Dude, Naval destroyed me on Twitter. Like I like posted some like point hack and he's like, I thought you sold a company, ratioed the hell out of me.
Do you still credit card churn?
I don't credit card churn. I don't do things that are like high effort, but like the basics, like, oh, if I'm spending money on shit, like, yes, I'll use a credit card. Yes, I'll get points. And I still struggle. Like if a flight is over $10,000, I still struggle, even though mathematically you're like, oh, you can afford to spend that.
Do you still mostly buy on sale items?
Not on sale item. Like now, like there'd be a time where if I'd go to e-commerce and, you know, you'd get a 20% new customer discount, I'd create another account. Now I don't do that. Now I'm like, that's too much effort.
You quit doing that yesterday.
But credit card points, I think if you spend a bunch of money, it like just helps a ton. Also, as a brown kid, it's very helpful to allow me to buy things for my parents. My parents will not accept me buying a ticket for them. But if I tell them the ticket comes from points, they have no problem accepting
it. Yeah, totally.
So it's like,
I do the
it's
same
like
thing.
Weird psychology. Like, yeah, exactly.
I told my sister, I was like, just tell her it's points.
Yeah.
And then don't bother with the points. It's going to be too confusing. Just get her the ticket. Could you tell me, I read somewhere that you've built a few things with AI to like personal software for your own life. What did you build? And also like, what do you see as the opportunity there?
So I was someone, again, for context, I had a computer science degree. I wrote enough code to launch the first version of Teachable, and I have not written a line of code in like 10 plus years. So I understand enough, but I just felt like everything kind of went away from me. Until now with AI, where it's again become super fun to play around with stuff and build small little apps. So I started by building things that like just like annoying workflows I have to do. Like every time we host a webinar, we have to download something from someplace, re-upload it somewhere else. Started building these sort of internal tools, but now it's reached a point where I have all these annoying, we're talking about home ownership, all these annoying things I need to do for my house. Building like a very simple sort of task management app just for myself is super useful. I think you're starting to see more and more people realize this, both for their business and for themselves.
What did you make?
So for now, it's a very simple task management app where there's certain things in my house I have to do at a different cadence. Property taxes, you pay quarterly, to change the fucking water filters once every X months. And you enter all these sort of tasks, as well as in some cases, if there's another person attached to them, and it kind of pulls it all automatically. It's like, oh, it's been, you know, like this month, here are the things that you should do, and here are the people that can do it. And again, this is something just for my own entertainment, amusement, whatever, but you can extrapolate how any local business can do it for whatever annoying things they have to do.
Sean, whenever I hear, so Ankur's single, I think, well, you're not, you're unmarried. Whenever I hear a single guy. Sorry, that sounded like, you know, I'm not your mother. I'm not trying to diss
this
you.
This already sounds like condescending.
No, it's
dad
not.
Type yeah. statement.
It's
where
not.
Like
listen.
Dad's like, well, it's so simple for you, but in my time, but go on.
No,
go on,
what I'm
go
saying
on.
Is, it's the opposite. What I'm saying is, okay. when I hear you describe this stuff, I think to myself, if I didn't have a wife or she just like walked out on me, I have no idea how I would handle any of this stuff. Like, I don't understand how a lot of our bills are paid. They're just kind of magically paid. And so when I have a bunch of my single friends, so like Sophia Amoruso, one of our mutual friends, she tells me about like all the time she has to spend doing all this. And I'm like, dude, I'm used to having two of us. You know, I wash, she dries. Like, I'm used to having two of us. To have one person manage all of this as part of a household when you own a home and when you have, like, responsibilities, that sounds so hard. You know what I mean, Sean? Can you imagine, like, having to do this stuff, like, everything?
I just wanted to see if you could land the plane on that one. And I would say...
Did I land it?
Yeah, he did.
It was like a Southwest, like, you know, there was a bump. There was like a little bump on the way down, but you did. You did.
What I'm saying is it's so much work. I don't understand how people do it.
Especially when you add in the dynamic of home ownership, especially as someone that grew up outside the US, so I have no actual life skills. Like, I feel like people in America, like, know how to do shit. They don't need a plumber. They've learned it somehow. But growing up outside the country, I'm not handy. So running a house is
quite a task. Wait, is that a stereotype that Americans know how to fix toilets?
Yeah. You don't think it's true?
Well, I do think that amongst all of my brown friends, my brown Asian friends, all of them hate Home Depot.
Yeah. Like, self-reliance was not a status symbol. In the US, it is a status symbol. Like, you are higher status if you can actually fix stuff. In India, it's like, oh, you have someone to do all this stuff for you.
Sam, it's not true. If you go to Home Depot on the first Saturday of every month, it'll be filled with Indian people. Do you know why?
No, what are they doing?
Because that's when they host the free Home Depot class where your kids can come build things. And it's totally free. They give you a kit and they build it. It's amazing. It's like a free educational thing. Only Indians in the store during first Saturday of the month. And it's, by the way, it's amazing. If you're not using this, you should use this.
Is that a true stereotype? Ramit has told me, he was like, my rich life, he like explains all this stuff and he ends it with like, and also to never step foot into a Home Depot.
Yeah. No, I mean, it definitely, at least when I first moved to America, it struck me as like strange how handy everyone was, but how much pride they took in it. Growing up, it was the opposite. It was weird to like, you know, even change a light bulb, maybe an exaggeration, but yeah, I definitely think being a homeowner here, as someone didn't grow up here, you're not prepared for it.
That's awesome. That's funny.
All right. Tell me about this like pickleball thing that you're writing about.
Oh, dude, this is, so I was like, in terms of things I spend money at, after food, my second biggest expense in New York right now is a sport called padel. It's pretty crazy. It's like,
it's not paddle.
Paddle, padel, whatever. Same thing. Same sport.
Well, I want to say it right.
It depends, like Latin America versus US. Either one is fine. It's spelled P-A-D-E-L, not P-A-D-D-L-E. So paddle, padel, whatever. It's incredible. It's become, in New York, it's sort of, there's a place near my office. It's like the closest we have to a country club because there's not enough space here. But you see, like a lot of our mutual friends are there. We go there all the time to hang out. But I think it's a bigger thing than that. If you look at the Google trend for the word, we're at a point now in the US where we're super, super early. There's like 2,000 courts here, and there's like 20,000 in Spain. It's on a fantastic trajectory upward. Incredibly fun sport, demographic with a high propensity to pay.
What is the difference between this and pickleball?
It is substantially more athletic. So a lot of people who play this are like, well, pickleball is a game, padel is a sport.
nice.
It is.
I like that. I do like a little bit of snobbery.
Pickleball is uniquely American in that, like, it's like, I don't know, it's so slow compared to anyone who's actually played sports. Like, padel has a lot of like ex D1 tennis players. Like,
exactly explaining the attributes of the game. You're more so just insulting
court?
Them.
Yeah.
Is it a bigger court or smaller paddle? Like, what's the difference?
The difference is that paddleball is just a bunch of fat, disgusting pigs, and they're slow, and they're athletic, and padel is the same thing. It's just Division I ex athletes.
Yeah. So imagine a slightly smaller yet wider tennis court with a back wall. It's a and a depressurized tennis ball. So it's quite fast because you have the back wall. So instead of hitting the ball out, it hits the back wall, bounces back, and you kind of go back and forth. Was really big in Latin America and Europe, and it's finally coming to the US in a way that I think you can go to any tier two city, spin up a location, and probably do quite well for the next few years. I think we're in this like unique sort of arbitrage opportunity. In New York, courts are about $300 an hour and booked out over weekends. And again, New York is probably the most extremely expensive market in the US, but it kind of cascades all the way downward.
And don't you have like a app? Well, I was with you one time and you're like, oh my God, someone just took my spot as the leader.
It's the worst. It's the game within a game. There's a rating every game you play. And it's insane because I'm playing with people that are all in their 30s, sometimes 20s and 40s, insanely good at their professional life, but they have this like unmet competitive need. So everyone is so aggressive about their rating, about their ranking. And a buddy of mine was texting me after we lost our match and we're both in a really bad mood. And he's like, I don't know why I'm so upset. I'm just thinking about my life. I have a wife that loves me. I have a beautiful daughter. Why am I so angry about?
But is it a self-reported system? How's the ratings?
So like we all have scores. Let's say I beat you, I enter that in the system, and the algorithm is like, oh, I'm a 3.9, Sam is a 2.6, but you only beat him by a little, so we actually went down despite beating him.
It's like an ELO score.
Exactly, and it's the most insane thing because you have all these people taking this way too seriously, right? Everyone has like real life jobs and responsibilities, but people get so cranky about this.
Like, is this a social network, basically, that somebody's built?
So there's a company called Playtomic that's built this in Europe, and they've white labeled it. I bet that that's also, by the way, a fantastic business. It's just, I don't know how big a market it is, but this one company has a monopoly on this little paddle, tennis, all these apps.
All right, listen, the two most beautiful words in the English language our email subscribers. You need more email subscribers. I guarantee it. I don't care how many you have. You need more of them. I need more of them. You need more of them. We all need more email subscribers because email is an amazing way to build your business, to build an audience, and to build a direct relationship that's not dependent on the TikTok algorithm, the Instagram algorithm. It's how you get people to engage directly with you so you can get them to trust you, to like you, click your products, check them out, check out your stuff. That's how you build a relationship with people. And the tool I use for my email subscriber base is Beehive. It's a tool that was built by the folks who were actually running Morning Brew. So they were running growth at Morning Brew. They grew it to 4 million subscribers. And along the way, they had to build out all these special tools in-house that made Morning Brew great. And so they took all those tools that they built internally and they said, could we provide those as a separate startup for anybody to use and not just Morning Brew? Because before Beehive, you were duct taping 5 different apps together. Well, now Beehive is just one tool that does it. And it's a single purpose thing. It's what I use for my newsletter. I send a newsletter out to over 100,000 people. And so for listeners of My First Million, they're actually doing a special code. So if you're thinking about, hey, I should have a newsletter, I should have subscribers, I kind of want to build an audience that way, well, check it out. They'll give you 30% off. Use the code MFM30. Go to beehive.com. That's BEEHIIV.com. And use the code MFM30. I'll put the link in the description to make it easy for you. Start scaling your content today. You said that New York has 1,000 courts and there's 20,000 in Spain?
In the U.S.
There's 1,000 only in the U.S. and there's 20,000 in Spain?
Correct.
Wow. That's pretty crazy.
And again, the Google trend for the sport, like just look it up or I can drop a graph. It's like straight up and to the right and picking up momentum.
So dumb question here, because squash and racquetball, almost an identical game to this. What are they just like? How mad are they that they just like sat there?
They're pretty mad. I mean, but squash has been on the fringes for a while. In the U.S., it's like either an immigrant sport or like rich white Ivy League like connotation. There's no in between. Paddle is also
Padel become any different.
It's become. I mean, it's globally. It's growing really, really fast, and I think it's all a case of like catching the right timing. And it's the sort of sport where you can play the first time and can kind of play it. Like tennis, you play the first time, you're pretty terrible. It'll take you months to, you know, get okay. But you can keep playing and keep getting better. So the community that's formed around it, I think, has been awesome to see. I think even Andrew Schultz was talking about it on Joe Rogan. And like it's starting to become a thing that we're still early. Like people are, like, I don't think it's anywhere hit mainstream consciousness, but like, I don't know. It's May 12th, 2025. Come back to this in 2 years. I think you're going to see a lot more of it.
Dude, Sean, last year, I went to a my friend held an event at the Padel Court, and I wasn't sure if Padel was a sport or a brand. I wasn't sure what it was. But when I went there, I think it was the same place, Ankara, that you go to. The whole place was all black, like black walls, like as if like berries or soul cycles. Like it had that vibe. And it was like everyone was like hot and cool. And like it was definitely a scene.
Were you good?
I didn't even play. I was like at an event, but I was like watching these people. And like I got the vibe when I got like when I got there, I was like, oh, they're like this is like a they're like, you know, they want to exclude people from coming here. Like that's like the vibe that I got. Like if I don't wear a collared shirt, they're going to kick me out. Like that's like that was the vibe that I got. Like I could smell the racism. You know what I mean?
Either pickleball or padel.
I try to play like real sports. I don't want to play those things.
You're a skateboarder.
That's a game. No, I don't. I don't really like. I feel silly playing paddleball, if I'm being honest.
The one thing I dislike about New York is it's so hard to have a country club or a place you go and can have all the sports. So I do think smaller spaces like this are potentially one of the answers. Because I have a bunch of friends that are like dads for the first time. A lot of them don't know how to make friends as an adult dude, right? Like they're like, hey, I've moved to a new city, or I don't like my old friends. And how do I actually make friends as a man that is not dating, not drinking, not going out? What do you do? And I think places like these are the answer quite often, since people come there, hang out, chill out, and some community forms around it and all that.
How do you meet friends, Sean?
No new friends, baby. No new friends. I'm trying to do a good job keeping in touch with my existing friends rather than make new friends. Now, there's a lot through the school, actually. So, like, once your kids get into school, the priority sort of shifts to, like, well, I'm going to be around these people anyways. Let me just find the coolest people of this group, because I already have, like, three things a month that I have to do with, you know, this set of people. So is there anyone here who I get along with? And then secondly, if I can, then I get the double win, because I get the play dates for my kids while I get to hang with somebody cool. So that became like the focus for me, rather than like, you know, going and individually making a friend. And then, you know, I got three little kids under 5 years old. Like if I'm going to go do a hangout with my friends, that's just like a choice that's only benefiting me. It doesn't really benefit like the whole, it doesn't integrate with the rest of my life. But I do play in a basketball league that I treat like uber seriously like this. Our friend Ruben runs a basketball league called SF Hoops. He's been doing it for like a decade. And we play one game a week, and you would think like, oh, it's just like this rec ball. Who cares? Pick up basketball, basically. But no, like I take it so seriously. Like basically the six other days of the week are just preparation for the one big game night. And then after that, you know, we come home and I basically get the footage off the AI camera, and then I start sending clips to the team. And I'm like, hey, like, you know, partially funny, like, you know, just commentary, but also like, yo, we got to correct this for next week. We can't do this again. And so we take it very, very, very seriously.
It's like exactly the same in our groups, because it's a 2-on-2 sport. People are sending coaching videos back and forth, and the whole thing is pretty insane.
You bought a piece of a cricket team?
I bought a piece of a cricket team.
What's the story here?
So again, flashback, I don't know, age 8 to 14, cricket was the only thing I cared about. I wanted to play professionally. I played internationally for the country I grew up in. It was sort of my first love. And I think we've all felt this, where the older you get, the more you're like, I want to do what like the 8 or 9 year old version of me thought was dope. And then I got in touch with someone who said one of the shareholders in what is the most valuable cricket team in the world, they're like worth roughly about $1 billion in the Indian league, was selling a stake. And I was like, this is the whole point of having money, right? To be able to do things like this. So I put in a bunch of dollars myself, also put together dollars from other investors. We now own a small piece of the team, but in time, the idea is can keep buying a bigger and bigger piece, since I joke about this a lot, but like,
you got to be like the non-douchey Chamath.
The douche part is uncertain for now. No, yeah.
Which team is it? And you like ballpark? Are we talking like 6 figures, 7 figures, 8 figures? How much did you put in?
I put, yeah. So I put in seven. The group we represent put in high seven figures, of which I think I was 20% was my own dollars. The valuation of the team was close to $1 billion. So as a percentage, it's still tiny. The team is called Chennai Super Kings. They've won, like, I want to say 6 championships. The Indian League is about 15 years old. So they've won more titles than any other team. Highest market cap. And dude, it's such a monopoly because India is the biggest country in the world and it's truly a one sport country. Like the delta between sport number one and sport number two is massive. And as far as the league goes, they just have so much room to run since it's still not that many teams. The market is maturing really fast. It already is the third richest league in the world. I think it's also a fantastic investment where, like, it's not going to generate tech startup returns, but it's unlikely to lose money. Like, there's such a long way the sport has to run.
You said it's the third most valuable league in the world?
Yeah. It's by TV rights per game, it's actually number two after NFL. And like by total revenue, it's more than any of the European soccer leagues, for instance, which is crazy for a league
like
that is
worth more than the Premier League. How is this possible? Yeah. How could the most valuable team be a billion, but the league be worth more than, like, there's like players in soccer that can almost make $1 billion.
Well, I'll quote my source after this, but it is the whatever source had it, the league being worth more than the European leagues, which I found crazy. And my interpretation was the European leagues are just very bad at monetizing their commercial value. Like, maybe the value in the league is to the team. So while Manchester United may be worth substantially more, the franchise value in the EPL may not be that much. That was my...
Gotcha.
Have you flown there and like participated in any of the...
I haven't had a chance to because this deal came together very recently. So I haven't done it yet. And long term, that's what I actually want. Like, everyone's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to like earn the upside? No, I want to draft players. I want to be able to kick people out. Like to me, long term, when I have time, that is the more fun part of this whole thing. Like, sure, don't lose money, but being an annoying, overly involved owner, I think awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if did you guys read about this VC dude in Europe who like bought a soccer team and then he put himself in the team?
Yeah, no, but that's awesome. That.
Yeah.
Who is that?
He's like a player on the team.
And it's so funny because 80, 90% of the world are like, oh, that's pathetic. I also was like, that's awesome. I would totally do it.
Did you guys watch the Netflix show or some? I forget what it was on, where Ryan Reynolds and...
Wrexham.
I didn't watch the show, but yeah, I read a lot about it.
How has it turned out, Sean? Do you know? That's been like 4 years.
I think it's going well. They got promoted, I think, a couple times, actually. I think they've moved up a couple times. We had a guy on the podcast, Haralabob, who did the same thing. He's bought a team in the, that's like, I don't know, third division team or whatever. I don't know which division they're in exactly, but they're, you know, up for basically promotion. And he's like bringing like Moneyball, which is, he's basically like a kind of data guy, and he's a sports bettor. That's his background. And so he's bringing like a Moneyball sort of approach to like drafting the right players and, or not drafting, but like, you know, signing the right players, playing the right strategy and selling at the right times on players.
Did you see the Celtics sold for $6.1 billion?
Yeah.
So that basically changed everyone's model, right? Because people were underwriting sports teams being worth one and then two and then maybe 2.5, 3. They sold for 6. It's kind of put into question just how much the rest of these teams can be worth. So,
well, who did they sell to?
Was it some PE group?
Yeah.
It just seems that the sports teams are just, it seems challenging. It seems like a very challenging thing I'm a little plebe, nobody, but it seems like challenging to have a proper market for it because it seems like one of those things that if you want it, you want it. Do you know what I mean? And
it's like a domain name. Like, it's very hard to be like, this domain is worth $400,000. There's such few, supply and demand is both like very, very limited.
There's 3 potential buyers, and whoever wants it, it will potentially pay. Like, if Jeff Bezos wants a sports team that he grew up with, he will almost pay an unlimited amount of money, and it doesn't have to make sense. And that sets the market price for the next 4 years.
Well, the number of billionaires keeps going up. The number of teams in the NBA stays the same.
Right? Yeah.
They're about to open up 2 new franchises, and each one of those will get $6 billion. And then that revenue goes to the other owners. And that's
two new franchises. Wait, what?
Like, the NBA is going to expand 2 more teams. They're going to do like a Vegas team, and they're going to do probably a Seattle team. and they wanted the Celtics franchise to sell at a very high price point so that they could then go to those new franchises and say, you're also a $5 to $6 billion price tag, which is pretty crazy. I mean, like, you know, when Mark Cuban bought the Mavs, I think he bought them for like 200 something million, right? Like the original Celtics owner just sold for $6 billion or whatever. He bought it originally for, I'd have to look it up, but it was like very low. It was basically like he compounded kind of like 20% over, you know, a 25-year period or something like that. And so he, you know, he did really, really well on that investment, won the championship last year, and then sold to this guy who had previously started a, or was a partner at this big PE shop. And that guy was a lifelong Celtics fan. And same thing, like, you know, it's a trophy asset that also has like all these other interesting things, which is like the media rights and other things that are...
There's in the US, you also get massive tax write-offs. Like, there's all kinds of weird tax stuff where like, some people have taken player contracts as a depreciating asset and use that depreciation to offset income. So crazy.
Right. And there's like a real estate play. So like basically some of the teams buy their own state. They own their own stadium. So they actually own the real estate. And then they buy the real estate right around the stadium because they're the hub. And so they know that that real estate right around it's going to be really worthwhile. Some people are trying to open up casinos because now sports betting is legal, which is like this whole other vector of like how to generate revenue. So you have all these. And then, by the way, your expenses are capped. There's a salary cap, so, like in the NBA, for example. So like you can only pay so much, but you can still earn, you know, you can still earn more and your franchise can go up in value.
I went and heard a talk by Mark Lazary. Do you guys know who that is? The Bucks. And he was telling a story. He was like, he's a billionaire and his whole thing is buying sports teams now. And he's like, there's basically two ways to run a sports league or a sports team. The first way is you run it profitably. And if you run it profitably, you will lose. Your team will lose. Or you run it in such a way where you lose $200 million a year and you win championships. And then you hope that you can sell it for enough money that it works out. So he's like, you either want to win and you got to have a lot of extra cash flow to cover this nut, or you're going to lose, but you'll be profitable. You pick one or two.
I bet it also depends on the sort of sports salary. Again, that was the whole Moneyball approach, right? Back in the day or whatever, where like you're spending a lot less, but relatively speaking, you're doing well. I think for a lot of people, it's at least for me, a lot of people who do this had at some point failed athletic ambitions. And there's a few ways those can manifest. Either you can make your kid play a bunch of sports or you can buy a sports team and still feel like you're doing the same thing.
Well, we talked to a guy.
I don't believe that thing is true. Like the Warriors win. The Warriors generate more revenue than anybody in the NBA. They're worth $9 billion now. Like they did all of the above. So I don't think that's necessarily true.
Revenue or profit?
They're also profit.
Well, it may be true in Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly. I think in small markets, yeah. that actually might be true.
Maybe.
And we were with Alexis at the basketball thing, Sean, and he was telling us about how he
bought the women's soccer team. No,
he bought the women's soccer team. He's starting a track league. Invested in that. He also told us about how he either did buy it or he was trying to buy a piece or a team in Tiger Woods' new golf league, or, you know, they have this weird like stadium golf league, which sounds pretty awesome. And he was like, well, the numbers sound crazy. I don't remember what he said, but let's say hypothetically it was $20 million. He's like, that sounds ridiculous, but let me explain the math. Like this sport gets this amount of views and they make this much money. This sport gets this amount of views. They make this much money. Therefore, he backed into it and it made incredibly, high numbers on the surface seem incredibly reasonable. I heard another guy do the same thing with sailing. This guy, Mark Lazar, he was like, I'm trying to buy a sailing league. And he was like explaining the numbers. And basically the whole business of the sports stuff was basically finding undervalued media rights and figuring out whose contract is going to end soon. And I want to purchase them and renegotiate the contracts in such a way where I get value.
Yep. And the US is so good at this. Like back to the European leagues, yes, some of them are massive teams, but I bet if you look at the numbers and how well they monetize eyeballs, it's terrible. Like in the US, you have very small leagues that are so good at like squeezing out every last dollar. Like the NFL obviously is like a world-class case study where they've monetized so well that they're literally hitting a point where they're like, we need to go outside the US to like meaningfully still grow from this point.
That's insane. Ankur, awesome hanging out with you, dude.
Yeah, it's great. Great. Thanks for having me.
Where do people find you?
So we're hosting a big conference for people who are seeing this, sponsored by a lot of people at HubSpot and The Hustle, called the OO Summit. It's this Friday. So we'll be seeing a bunch of people there. Otherwise, I'm active on social media. My Twitter is my name. And for any tax optimization stuff, carrie.com.
All right. We appreciate you. That's it. That's the pod. I feel like I could rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, less travel, never looking back.